Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Calling all university students, immerse yourself in the ancient and medieval Roman intellectual tradition while living in the Eternal City. Apply now for our Spring 2025 Study Abroad program. The deadline is August 15th, and space is limited. Don't miss out. Apply today at ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
So I approach the theory of evolution from the Aristotelian Thomistic perspective, as it has been mentioned. And first, I will map the situation for us here in terms of where this tradition, in my opinion, can be helpful in a broader conversation on philosophical and theological presuppositions and repercussions of evolutionary theory. So, topics where we or this tradition can contribute. First, when you approach evolutionary theory in its philosophical aspects, then there is a number of relevant conversations where this tradition can be helpful, and it may enter these conversations. First of all, a very complex and difficult conversation on the definition of species in biology and philosophy of biology. Then the notion of stability and change, how things, how we understand stability of things, both empirically and philosophically speaking, and then how can one thing change into another, which is obviously important for evolutionary theory. Then goal-directedness, or teleology from Greek telos, that is end, and chance. So what is more important, or whether those two aspects are in play at play in evolutionary theory, or maybe just one of them dominates and the other is useless or does not play any role. And then if we have a definition of species, let's say, in philosophy of biology and metaphysics, then how can one species change into another species? So trying to develop a meaningful metaphysical model of speciation. And here, one side topic which is also important is the question of whether how something more perfect, philosophically speaking, can come from something less perfect in the process of evolutionary transitions. This is one of the controversies which is oftentimes in the ecclesiastical and some Catholic circles, but Protestant circles as well, used against accepting a theory of evolution from the perspective of philosophy and theology. This is philosophy. On the theology part of the conversation, obviously, how do we interpret the book of Genesis in the context of evolutionary theory? Aquinas would have something really interesting to say here. Then, if we assume that evolution happens, and then if it happens, then what it is with respect to God? Would it be a part of divine creation, as many theistic evolutionists claim, or maybe rather a part of divine governance and not creation, which I say in my book, and I defend and develop this position against mostly everybody in this field. I have reason for that, but I will not mention them today. Maybe if there's time and questions afterwards, I will do that. And then if evolution happens and God is engaged, so what would be the interaction of divine and creaturely causation in evolutionary transitions? How can we build a model of those transitions? And then obviously we have a difficult question of evil, natural and physical evil in evolutionary transitions. And eventually, one of the most difficult controversies related to theory of evolution from the theological point of view, that is how human beings came into existence and how can we bring it, evolution of human beings in biology, in to be in agreement with what we believe about the origin of human species. Okay, so these are topics that I address in my book. Here's the book. If you want to see it, you can come afterwards. I actually recently put it into the longest paper I have ever published, but still a paper version of the book. So if you are interested, you can. The paper is free. The book, unfortunately, is not free. You have to pay for it. But I have a reduction on the price, 20%. So you can ask for that code. Okay. So what I would like to speak today, and I was asked to speak today about just one aspect of this conversation, or of one of those conversations that I've mentioned, that is goal-directedness or teleology and chance in evolution. So The question, obviously, from philosophical and theological perspective would be clearly or purely this. Is evolution a purely mechanistic process run by randomness or chance, as many philosophers of biology in the 20th century claimed? Or, and it dismisses and rejects and destroys any notion of directedness or teleology in biology, or maybe that's not necessarily the case. So let's dive into this topic. So first, before we will give voice to Darwin himself, let's look on those who knew him, who commented on his work, because they say things that are important and stunning in a way in the context of the broader conversation here. Asa Gray, the most important American botanist in the 19th century, who had a conversation, an exchange of letters with Darwin, he says this: the great service rendered by Darwin to natural science is restoring teleology, goal-directedness, to natural science. And Darwin actually responds to this letter, saying in his letter, "What you say about teleology pleases me especially, and I do not think anyone else has ever noticed that important point." Francis Darwin, who is Darwin's son, who published his autobiography, he says about his father this: "One of the greatest services rendered by my father to the study of natural history is the revival of teleology." And one more example, I just bring those important voices here. Thomas Huxley, who was Darwin's spokesman, we may say, who was no friend of philosophy, classical philosophy, and especially theology. He rejected vehemently theology and especially Catholicism. But he says, perhaps, again, the most remarkable service to the philosophy of biology rendered by Darwin is bringing back teleology to biology. Is that true about Darwin? Well, let's go to Darwin himself. A few examples from his book. One of them, he says this: "Every detail of structure has been produced for the good of its possessor." Well, from philosophical perspective, this is teleological language. There is a goal for instantiation of features or sustaining those features in living organisms. Another example: "As natural selection works solely by and for the good of each being, all corporal and mental endowments will tend to progress towards perfection." So it seems there is, again, a teleological language present in his writings. At the same time, or on the other hand, Darwin would say something like this: "In my theory, there is no absolute tendency to progression, excepting from favorable circumstances. Any broad view of purposefulness in evolution would be absolutely devastating for my theory," he says. And in one of his letters, speaking about theology, surprisingly, not an area of his specialization, he says, "My theology is a simple model. I cannot look at the universe as the result of blind chance, yet I can see no evidence for beneficent design, or indeed design of any kind." So some commentators would say this clearly shows how he is confused on this topic, but I think it's not actually the case. I think it shows that intuitively, Darwin knows that there is no biology without teleology, but at the same time, he intuitively thinks that teleology, if applicable, is applicable to particular organisms or maybe the principle of natural selection, but there is no overarching goal directedness of the entire process of evolutionary transitions that would lead to some one eschatological end. This is not something that he as a biologist can accept at all. So I think he intuitively distinguishes those important aspects of this conversation, but he doesn't say it clearly and openly. Now, surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, if we know a history of science and philosophy of science, the direction shifts right after he publishes his book. So after those first reactions coming from his friends and family, we have an example here, Hermann von Helmholtz, who was a German botanist and physiologist. He claims and praises Darwin for bringing the study of biological form under the ambit of mechanism, by which he means rejecting the whole idea of natures of things, natural teleology and natural tendencies. Everything is run by chance that is working on mechanical structures of living things. 100 years later, a founding father of contemporary philosophy of biology, David Hall, he says, from the point of contemporary biology, both vitalism and teleology are stone cold dead. One year later, famously, Jacques Monod brings this to a logical conclusion, train of thought that is developed in logical positivism, and says chance alone is at the source of every innovation. Pure chance, absolutely free but blind, at the very root of the stupendous edifice of evolution. This is the sole conceivable hypothesis, the only one that squares with observed and tested fact. I mean, this is something really strong and surprising for a philosopher to say that there's no other option where in philosophy there's always a zillion of options and no one agrees about which one to choose. But anyway, and then we have Dawkins just once. He is overused and abused. I mean, enough of Dawkins. But I mean, he brings even more metaphysical conclusions from what Monod says, saying that there's no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Now, is it really true? I would say not necessarily, and in order to realize it, we have to distinguish crucial categories in this conversation. And there are three crucial categories, two of them mentioned by Howe in his quotation from him that you saw on this slide. And these three categories are teleology, design and function, and vital forces or vitalism. These are metaphysical, philosophical categories related to biology that were developed throughout the history of philosophical reflection on living world. So, teleology first. Goes back to ancient philosophy, goes back to Aristotle, where he defines teleology as that for the sake of which a thing is done, or a good that can be attained and that is proper for a given being. This being can be immaterial, material, living or non-living. Everything in the universe for him has a proper nature to it and a teleology that leads to instantiation and fruitful realization of this nature. What is crucial for him, this cause, or because he will say that this is a cause of things, a final cause, it is not a mysterious quasi-mechanistic efficient cause acting from the future on present. Rather, this is natural tendency here and now to develop in the future in such a way that, let's say here, organism flourishes and realizes all its dispositions that it has from the beginning of its formation. And he will also emphasize that this is a tendency that does not have to be known or intended by a conscious agent. He says it is absurd to suppose that purpose is not present because we do not observe the agent deliberating. So he sees this teleology as a natural disposition or aspect of each and every existing thing in the universe. Now, Thomas Aquinas brings it or moves it forward in one way or the other, and we can speak, in my opinion, about three levels of inquiry concerning teleology, which he develops being a theologian, not just a philosopher. The point of departure is observation, empirical observation of think acting for some ends. You know, plants are producing flowers, seeds, and so forth. We can observe teleological action, and we name teleological organs. Wings are for flying, heart is to pump blood, and so forth. So on this account, this is a real language, not just metaphors, but language that refers to some real fact about things, which is goal-directedness. Now, at the level of philosophy of biology here, we would then defy it, or metaphysics, as a principle, again, of goal-directedness or teleology. And then at the level of theological conversation, we would say that, Aquinas would say, that there is the first teleological cause of everything in nature. This is God, who acts as the source and ultimate goal of all teleology, and he acts in nature through this natural teleology characteristic of inanimate and animate creatures, who are, with respect to God, secondary causes, and God is the primary cause in nature. So we have empirical phase, we have philosophical phase of our conversation, and we have theological phase, where and the last phase may be summarized by Aquinas in this way. All things desire God as their end when they desire some good thing proper to their nature, because this notion of teleology this notion of teleology is normative for Aristotle and Aquinas. It sets up the norm which is proper for a given being. So they desire God when they desire what is good for them. Whether it is they desire it by intellect, human beings, or sensible desire, animal beings, or natural desire, which are as plants and inanimate creatures. That is, without knowledge, they still desire God, metaphysically speaking, because God is the source of all teleology. So we can say that we have, and we can distinguish within this school of thought, teleology at the level of an organism, once again, maybe a population, and this is the field of biology and philosophy of biology that works on that, and teleology at the level of all evolutionary processes, right? In theological reflection, we may say God guides all processes of evolution in a given way, leading them to some eschatological fulfillment, but we are aware that this is a theological claim and not biological or not even philosophical claim, right? Now, what happened on the way was the development and proposal of the notion of or category of design and function. This happens in reaction to mechanicism developed with the advent of modernity. One of the responses which comes within the British movement of physical theology, this is how it was named, is this argument for design in favor of design and function. And here is how William Paley, who is the most important exemplar of this argument, how he formulates this argument. That happens within the context of Protestant Anglican theology. He says, again, point of departure is similar. We observe biological structures in terms of their complexity and order. We then make another proposition. We assume that this order and structure, they are functional, and they must be therefore formed and put together for a purpose. So there is a hint of teleology there as well. But then he brings it to the conclusion that there needs to be a purposeful and intelligent, listen carefully, extrinsic agent behind this complexity and functional ends of biological structures. So he gives this his famous example of a watch. He says, when you find a watch in a desert, you figure that this watch must have had a maker. There must have existed at some time and some place or other an artificer or artificers who formed it for the purpose for which it functions. Now, what is crucial here is that he doesn't say that this artificer works through this watch. No, he is an extrinsic artificer who made this watch, and this watch now functions by itself. Right? So there is an intrinsic tendency, because he will obviously say, refer it to God bringing design and functionality in nature. But there is an intrinsic tendency here to speak of God as coming from outside into nature, working within nature as one cause among other physical causes, and physically changing things in nature. Right? So not as in Aquinas, where God is transcendental and acts through secondary causes in nature, but God miraculously enters reality and changes and pokes things here and there to bring this design. Now, Paley himself is more careful than this, and he does actually say this, at least at one point in his book. Whatever is done, God could have done without the intervention of our instruments or means, but it is in the construction of instruments that a creative intelligence is seen. So he acknowledges the fact that God can work through instruments, through secondary causes in nature, but look what he adds to it. In this way, God limits his own power to give space for them to act in nature. This is something Aquinas would absolutely reject. For Aquinas, God works from the transcendental perspective in nature, so everything that happens in nature is done 100% by God and 100% by creatures. Right? Whereas for Paley, there's a division of labor. So God somehow enters this reality in one way or the other and changes things and then is in a competition in a way with natural causes. So this tendency to speak about divine action in univocal terms as an agent next to other agents in nature, this tendency is present in this argument, and it is also present in the intelligent design movement today. I will not address this topic in more details, but I just want to mention that. So this is the argument of the intelligent design school. If we can see irreducible complexity in nature, there needs to be an extrinsic intelligence that intervenes in nature and brings this complexity to reality. Now, the third category mentioned here before is the category of vital forces of or vital spark of or élan vital. What is it? Well, again, in response to mechanical philosophy developed in 15th and 16th centuries, especially in response to Thomas Hobbes, who was a first British philosopher who offered a completely atheistic notion of mechanical approach to nature, unlike many other philosophers who actually used it in favor of God, but he introduced an atheistic version of mechanicism. So Cambridge Platonists, they were called a group of philosophers at Cambridge, they postulated the existence of a non-material but not intelligent, they called it plastic nature, like a unique type of cause or principle that was present only in living beings, making them to be what they are as living beings. So John Ray, from the same school of thought, he makes it this argument or moves it towards the category of vitalism, of this vital force, non-physical, but still he used the term force that makes living beings to be what they are. Kaspar Wolf, who developed embryology, one of the founding fathers of embryology in Germany, he also thought in this way about living things. And later on, in late 19th century, Hans Driesch, further development in embryology, a good famous biologist, and Henri Bergson in philosophy, he claims that he introduces this notion of this force, élan vital, which is for him a vital impetus, goal-directed non-physical force which explains evolutionary changes. So why do I bring those three categories here? Because if we want to answer the question whether Darwin was in favor of teleology, we need to realize that he responds actually to this conversation that happens among people following those three schools. He responds to them in one way or the other. So, contemporary scholarship trying to understand what happens in Darwin says this. Some of philosophers, like Michael Giselin, he says, there is a myth based on those quotations that I brought at the very beginning of this lecture, that Darwin somehow brought teleology back into biology. And he says, this is mistaken. He did something absolutely opposite to it. He got rid of teleology and replaced it with a new way of thinking about adaptation, a mechanistic thinking about adaptation. But others, philosophers of biology, they say, well, you cannot say this, because like there are numerous places in his book where he says that natural selection, as here, acts for the good of each being, and its products are present for various functions, purposes, and ends. I mean, this is clearly teleological language. So one of the great scholars in Aristotle's biology, who is also knowledgeable about Darwin, he says, what Darwin actually does, he reinvents teleology. He was encouraged by many who reacted to the first edition of his book to reject the notion of natural selection or the category of natural selection, but he said that he cannot do it because it is crucial for evolutionary transitions. And by doing this, James Lennox says, in the historical context where once teleological choices were what? Either goal-directed vital forces, élan vital from Bergson, or divinely designed adaptation with God entering nature and changing things directly through his miraculous action, Darwin rejects those two ideas and he introduces a selection-based natural teleology. And funny enough, or paradoxical enough, Huxley, once again, I will bring him here, he says, while Darwin's theory had dealt the death blow to special creation, once again, God entering nature and changing things in nature directly, we must say that there is a wider teleology which is not touched by the doctrine of evolution, but is actually based upon the fundamental proposition of theory of evolution. Harry Smith from Department of Health Ethics and Philosophy at the University of Limburg in Netherlands, he says, Darwin did not replace teleology by evolutionary explanations, but showed how we can understand teleology without referring to a designer who would come from the outside and change things here inside of the world. He eliminated the concept of design and rehabilitated Aristotelian teleological explanations where we can speak about natural teleology and tendencies in existing things. And it is true, Darwin rejects the idea of perfect design instantiated by God who enters nature. And he has at least three arguments for that. He says we can see new types of organisms replacing preceding ones. That would mean the design was imperfect if those organisms ceased to exist. We can see differences among organisms belonging to the same biological type or species in different parts of the world. That would mean there's no one perfect design brought by God. And then we see vestigial organs, which are a sign of imperfection of design as well. So Darwin, who when he was young followed Paley and he enjoyed Paley's argument, at later stage in his life, when he develops evolutionary theory, he vehemently rejects Paley. He also rejects vitalism. And what he does, once again, as another expert in the field says, he basically introduces teleology once again, and there's an isomorphism between Darwin's biological vision and Aristotle's, and had Aristotle known biology of today, he would basically do the same thing. This is what claims Alan Gotthoff. Now, this is the conversation that happens in most recent scholarship. Now, in the 20th century, when the 20th century evolutionary synthesis was developed, we have a conversation that takes place on teleology at that point. And this is still the era of, dying out, but still logical positivism present there. So three founding fathers of this synthesis, Theodosius Dobzhansky, he says, mutation alone, uncontrolled by selection, will simply lead to breakdown and eventual extinction of life, and not to the adaptive progressive evolution. So there needs to be some teleology. He doesn't use the term, but this is his intuition. Now, another very important thinker, Francisco Ayala, who was trained as a Dominican and left the order right after ordination, but he got training in Aristotle, so he knew his Aristotle, and he says, natural selection is creative in a way. It produces adaptive genetic combinations which would not have existed otherwise, and he says natural selection is teleological in the sense that it produces and maintains end-directed organs and processes. The third member of this team, Ernst Mayr, vehemently reacts against what Francisco Ayala says. Why? Because he understands this notion of teleology in a mistaken way, again, as something from the future acting on the present. So he says, well, we cannot do without functionality and some sort of goal-directedness, but let's not use the term teleology because this is an inappropriate term. So he introduces in philosophy of biology another term, teleonomy, where it would be sort of teleology but grounded in the information written in the DNA. He says there's a program in DNA and this program is being actualized and maybe this is some sort of teleology, but let's call it teleonomy. Or there is at this time after or still within logical positivism, the emphasis on what explains in their understanding of the reality, what explains in science are laws of nature. So teleomatics would be the process that reaches an end state. So it's oriented towards some end state caused by the laws of nature. He says this in reference to Colin Pittendry, who is a philosopher who says teleology in its Aristotelian form absolutely cannot be accepted. It is nonsensical because this is something, again, acting from the future on the reality today. So Ayala, under this pressure, actually gives up at some point, unfortunately, and he says, well, maybe those teleological explanations can be reduced to non-teleological ones because he was so vehemently criticized by Ernst Mayr. Now, after this, when we enter the contemporary status of teleology in philosophy of biology, we have, on the one hand, still those who say, no, teleology in biological explanations should be reduced and rejected. It is anthropomorphism, and it might be a useful fiction, but it should be dismissed and reduced to non-teleological factors. So everything should be explained at the level of biochemistry and chemistry and physics. But others say, no, the explanations in science that were based on laws of nature only in logical positivism, that is deductive, nomological, and inductive statistical explanations, they are replaced specifically in biology not only by genetic, historical, and structural explanations, which are important for evolutionary biology, but also by functional and teleological types of explanation. So Dennis Walsh, a philosopher who writes a chapter on teleology for the Oxford Handbook of Philosophy of Biology, says, well, let's be clear here. Teleology is observed in the adaptiveness and phenotypic plasticity of organisms, manifested in their self-organizing goal-directedness and capacity to make compensatory changes to form or physiology during their lifetime. So teleology happens on the level of evolutionary, is important at the level of evolutionary transitions, and these are other names who follow Dennis Walsh, but the conversation continues and they are those who are against them, because as I said, in philosophy, people tend to agree less than in natural science. Now, what does, so atomists are happy about that, but not, well, we have our contribution here, which is a critical one. Because in all this, what I have presented so far, it seems that both Darwin and the 20th century school of evolutionary biology, those who favor teleological explanations, they tend to think that natural selection is teleological. But if we would agree that natural selection is the biological law of nature, I leave aside the question whether in biology we have laws as in other sciences and chemistry and physics, long and complex conversation. But if it is natural selection, if it is a biological law of nature, then we have to realize, as a Jesuit scholar, a physicist who worked in a Vatican observatory here in the States, in Tucson, Arizona, he says, the laws of nature are not making things to be what they are and operate in a given way. Rather, laws of nature, they describe things that work in a given way. In other words, laws of nature from a metaphysical, a philosophical point of view are descriptive and not prescriptive. So if this is true, then natural selection cannot be teleological, because that would mean that it is somehow an agent that makes things to be one way or the other. So critical about this claim that teleology is present in natural selection in evolution, I would say that teleology, which again is indispensable for evolutionary transitions, is not so much located again or grounded in natural selection, but rather basically, but in philosophy, basic solutions are sometimes really profound, in organisms themselves, that strive to survive and produce fertile offspring. So this is really important, because biologists at the level of evolutionary biology, they tend to take it for granted that the material on which they work and or where they begin their study are living organisms that are teleological, basically. And without this, I mean, we wouldn't have evolution, because those changes that happen through mutations, they work on a biological material that is of certain type or kind. And it has this feature to it, that it is basically teleological. So having said this, one last step in this conversation is the step taken most recently in recent 2 or 3 decades, where we can speak about the extended evolutionary synthesis. So in my understanding of an exposition of the history of development of evolutionary theory, that would be the 4th stage. We have Darwinism, Neo-Darwinism, then 20th century synthesis, and this most recent new, which is still actually in making, extended evolutionary synthesis. And what is fascinating in this approach is that we have learned that standard evolutionary theory was a gene-centric theory. Now we are past genocentrism in biology, and we push our understanding of evolutionary transitions away from genocentrism, and which actually brings us in one way or the other to become organism-centric in our approach to biological material, which is very important. And according to this extended evolutionary synthesis, genetic inheritance is not the only inheritance system in evolution, right? We now have advanced studies on development, and the the interrelationship between evolution and development. We also know about epigenetic features that are being transmitted from generation to generation, but also we now work on cultural aspects of interaction of organisms in populations that are again transmitted from generation to generation outside of genetic inheritance. We also work on behavioral, physiological, and ecological inheritance, which includes niche construction. And we treat all these as channels of inheritance that can pass traits on to the next generation. So trying to say or to map the same argument here. So classically, we would have this concentration, in especially in neo-Darwinism, on DNA mutations, recombination, gene transfer, genetic drift, right? They lead to changes to phenotype of organisms in a given lineage of a given species that strive to survive and produce offspring. Then we have natural selection and isolation barriers. And this is the 20th century synthesis of evolutionary synthesis. Today, we add those factors that I've mentioned a minute ago. So only all these factors lead to speciation, right? Which is an origin of a new lineage L2, let's say, that belongs to a new species S2. So we have therefore moved from evolution understood in a very simplistic, actually, way in terms of phylogenetic relationships to a more complex view of evolution when we discovered the relation between evolution and development and epigenetics, to an even more complex picture view of the reality, where we now take into account all those relationships of organisms, not only with their ancestors, but with all other organisms around them, nature, ecological niche, and so forth. So you can see how messy is the picture of evolutionary transitions today. And you can imagine, therefore, how difficult it is for us when we take all this, to take all this into account and to find those lineages where new species come into existence. But we realize more and more that we have to do it, because otherwise our picture view of evolution will be fairly inadequate. So those who are in a way open in a very important paper a way to this new development in evolutionary theory, they say something surprising. They say the evidence for evolution is better than ever, but the role of natural selection in evolution, however, is seen to play less an important role. It is merely a filter for unsuccessful morphologies generated by development, and development and all the interactions that I've mentioned here and aspects of it play more important role in a way than evolution, which is just than natural selection, which is just this checkpoint whether given structure works or not. And what is important from our perspective is that there's plenty of teleological aspects of this conversation when we think about all those additional aspects of evolutionary transitions that I listed here. So Dennis Walsh, in a summary of this paper that I already mentioned, he says that natural sciences learn to live without teleology, having rejected vehemently Aristotle's notion of teleology. But the understanding of how evolution can be adaptive today, our understanding of it today, requires us to incorporate teleology, and natural science must, whether it likes it or not, once again learn to live with teleology. Okay, but can we then say it is just teleology and chance doesn't play any role anymore, so we now have, you know, go to the other extreme, chance is not important? Well, not really. But again, the school that I come from, the classical school of Aristotle and Aquinas, has something interesting to say with respect to chance as well. Because when we say chance, well, what do we really mean by that? And philosophically speaking, again, it is not an easy, there's no easy answer to this question. Well, one of the available definitions would say this. What is chance? Something that happens unpredictably without a natural and a discernible non-human cause or a discernible human intention, where the assumed impersonal purposeless determiner of unaccountable happenings defined in 1b here can also be called fortune or luck. Now, we usually relate chance to randomness, right? And randomness describes a phenomenon in which one outcome, in which the outcome of a single repetition of a given occurrence is uncertain, but we can, with the tools of statistics and probability, we can predict for the future, right? But this is true, But we have to be aware of the fact that chance is not equivalent with randomness. Randomness may be an effect of chance and can be again captured by statistics and probability, but it does not answer to the question what chance actually is. And I think it still remains a difficult question. And Aristotle has an interesting thing to say in this respect. He says, let's see at, what happens in nature. We have events that, if we believe that teleology is real and true, we have events that happen with a deliberate intention as a result of human thought, and we have events that happen with no deliberate intention, but still purposefully because there is natural teleology, right? So he says, when things that usually happen with human intention tend to pass or happen to pass incidentally, that is without a deliberate intention, that so that we cannot find a deliberate intention staying behind them, we say that they are the outcome of luck or fortune. Bad or good, luck or fortune. When those things that happen without deliberate intention, but in reference to natural teleology happen spontaneously, that is without realization of a natural disposition of a given entity, we tend to call them chance. Now he says then, therefore, he asks himself a question, is chance a cause of things? On this picture view of the reality, can we say, and this is a controversy, can we say that chance is a cause? Or if it is not a cause, then what is it, right? And why it and how it explains if it is not a cause? So Aristotle says this. Let's say we should distinguish, he says, per se or proper causes. For him, this would be material, formal, efficient, and final causes of entities and occurrences in nature. And he says they always come, are functions or are grounded in natures of things or intellect in case of a human being, which is part of human nature as well. But he says there are also in nature per accident or accidental causes. Causes or quasi-causes, he would say, that need to be referred to per se causes or of a given entity or occurrence to predict anything about them. So he gives here an example. Just as in metaphysics, basic metaphysics that he develops, we have substances like myself, let's say, I'm a substance, and there is a substantial form that decides that I am who I am, but there are also accidental features of my person. The color of my hair that is actually changing, the color of my eyes, which is not changing, and so forth. So Aristotle says that we can take this and analogically speak about per se and accidental causes, right? So let's say he says we have a fair-skinned and musical sculptor who made a statue. So we may say that a fair-skinned and musical person made a statue, but it is not a per se cause of statue. Rather, per se cause of statue is the action of his muscles or her muscles, right? So taking this or applying this distinction to chance and per se causes, he says this, that chance is an unusual accidental cause. And as such, it is inherently unpredictable, although it still falls in the category of events that happen for the sake of something, because it happens always in the contexts of things that happen for the sake of something. So we have a tendency to say that chance leads to something or is a cause, but he says, in fact, from a metaphysical point of view, it is a quasi-cause. And he therefore emphasizes that chance events are due to nothing in the substance or per se causes, which happens to concur with these unexpected occurrences. And yet, as an accidental cause, chance occurs always and only in reference to per se causes. There wouldn't be the color of my eyes or a color of my hair without there being myself, there being me. And same with chance. There wouldn't be chance, says Aristotle, hadn't there been teleology, functionality, and regularity of nature. The chance for Aristotle, therefore, is posterior and inherently related to natures of things and intellect in case of human beings. And thus it is associated with formal and final causality rather than mechanic material necessity. So he would say this: things do in a way occur by chance, for they occur incidentally, and chance is an incidental cause. But strictly speaking, it is not the cause without qualification of anything, because it is like a parasite on regularity and order in nature. Chance and fortune are, for him, therefore, ontologically real. They are not merely epistemological, our lack of knowledge of true causes that we simply don't know as of yet. He would rather treat chance as a real ontological phenomenon, weird phenomenon, and he struggles with it considerably in his writings. But he would say that it is not a cause by itself, but rather functions as a quasi-cause or a parasite on regularity and order. By saying this, he rejects both radical indeterminism, that is, chance running the edifice of nature, as Monod would say, but he also rejects radical determinism, because this teleology in natural things for Aristotle, in, like myself, it's always suppositional. Supposedly, there is nothing on the way and nothing stops an organism in its development, be it an external cause that interacts with it or chance, this organism will develop and flourish. So there is a level of determinism with teleology always, but this determinism is never absolute. So he avoids absolute determinism and absolute indeterminism in his understanding of nature. So, bringing all this to a conclusion, we may say that teleology and chance cooperate in evolution. Aristotle's and Aquinas' philosophy of nature reminds us that we always have to take formal and final causality into account in our attempt to explain the nature of evolutionary changes. Evolution is an interplay of regularity, suppositional determinism, as I said, and chance, spontaneity, but it is not a radical and total spontaneity. One of these aspects cannot do without the other. Once again, ontologically real chance events, that is mutations, that produce those minor variations, remain in a synergy with the regularity and teleological character of life cycles and transmission of features between generations through genetics at the level of genes and beyond the level of genes. And interestingly enough, if we would like to give voice to Darwin at the end of this entire talk, which in a way is ignored by Monod, Darwin says this: listen, chance alone, one might say, could make a difference in a given trait of an organism with respect to its parents, but that would never be enough to explain the fundamental difference between species belonging to the same genus. Chance by itself, Darwin is aware of the fact that this machinery of biology has many other aspects to it, so it would be not justified to say chance runs evolution. Evolution, therefore, cannot be attributed to a blind chance, as many philosophers of biology in 20th century thought. That would actually lead to giving up the possibility to explain the reality of biological material and biological changes that happen in evolutionary theory. So in this way, I believe this classical school, as you can see, it not only encounters the conversation that one of the conversations that I brought up here in philosophy of biology today as a school that wants to learn and defend itself in encounter with evolutionary biology, because this is our traditional school, classical school, and because classical theology, Catholic theology, is based on this school in a considerable way, we would then ask biology to accept us and say, well, can we be part of the conversation as somebody who just learns and wants to be accepted? Well, not only, rather, I would say this school has something interesting to offer in this conversation. It has a profound a model of understanding of chance in relationship to teleology, a profound understanding of teleology, and shows how we can locate ourselves in the middle ground, avoiding radical indeterminism and radical determinism with respect to understanding of nature. If you are interested in this topic and you would like to read more, the entry-level introduction to teleology includes a number of interesting publications. So I can share the presentation, and if you are interested, you may look into these. And if you are interested in the Thomistic, Aristotelian Thomistic approach to theistic evolution, I am not the first one who develops it, although I believe I bring something new to this conversation. There is a number of other thinkers who thought and worked on it before me. And last thing is, once again, an advertisement of the book. If you are interested, I have this discount on it for the purpose of those talks that I give around the book and or the paper that is available online. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm now open to questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.